You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ever since its creation in 1948, Pakistan has been among the leading recipients of U.S. aid, which has totaled more than $48 billion, with nearly one-half going to its military. After Osama bin Laden was discovered and killed in Abbottabad earlier this year, President Barack Obama has come under increasing pressure to justify U.S. aid and spending in the country. Relations with Pakistan have become tense, and the military aid has been temporarily suspended. Here to discuss the current situation inside Pakistan is Pamela Constable, a foreign correspondent, former deputy foreign editor at The Washington Post. Her book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself, is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased it has brought Pamela Constable to our show today. Hello.
Good morning. Well, nice to be here.
How much of our annual aid of $800 million has been specifically designated to the military?
I couldn't say on a yearly basis, but over time, it's certainly been lion's share has always gone to the military.
But doesn't the military play more of a role in India's economy than most militaries? So if you're giving money to the military, you're also giving money to many businesses in Pakistan.
Well, yes. I mean, there's sort of not necessarily a trickle-down effect, but maybe a trickle-sideways effect. But in fact, what has happened is that there's been such a skew towards defense spending that it really has come at the expense of social spending, particularly on health and education, which is a big problem when you have 180 million people, many of whom need schooling and jobs desperately.
Since Pakistan has nuclear weapons, many argue that there are great risks in suspending military aid. Well, how risky is it?
Well, you know, the relationship between these two countries, militarily, strategically, has been going on for a very long time. And yet the relationship now, as you mentioned previously, has become so fraught with tension and mistrust that I think the American officials felt something had to be done. A message needed to be sent, and I think they probably did the right thing.
Was the reaction to the discovery and the killing of Osama bin Laden really the last straw? Because we've been talking about this sort of thing for a while now, haven't we?
Yes, and in fact, you know, there are many people who would argue that we should have called their bluff a long time ago. Now, we don't know for sure, you know, how high or wide the knowledge of bin Laden's presence there went. But the fact is that the decision not to let the Pakistanis know that we were going after him is very significant. And the impact that it's had, particularly within the military, has been extraordinary. I mean, the whole institution feels humiliated, which is a very rare feeling for it.
What is the Pakistani public's response to all of this? Do they believe that the military was unaware of Osama bin Laden's presence?
Generally speaking, yes. There are no good choices in that alternative, because either they didn't know, in which case they looked ridiculous, or they did know, in which case they look much worse. Here they are getting all this money from us, all this supposed military and intelligence sharing, and yet there we are.
On the other hand, didn't a majority of Pakistanis, weren't they outraged that the United States did this?
Absolutely. More so than they were by far than at the fact that he was there, which is very telling.
There's a report in today's New York Times about FBI claims that Pakistan's military, including Inter-Services Intelligence, its spy agency, has funneled $4 million over the past two decades to influence American foreign policy in regard to India and Kashmir. Is our aid money coming back to us as campaign donations to members of Congress and presidential candidates?
Well, we don't know all the details yet, and it's not surprising. Generally speaking, it's surprising a little bit specifically because they're talking about individuals who've been here a very, very long time, very publicly and consistently promoting the Kashmir cause. So they've certainly had a very public role here, and to discover a possible covert one is really quite shocking.
There are Pakistanis who are now U.S. citizens, but failed to register with the Justice Department as agents of Pakistan as required by law.
Right.
The bulk of the money went to the Republican National Committee and to Senator Dan Burton of Indiana. Why them?
Well, you know, I literally know very little. This is all brand new news to me, so I don't know much about that. But I would say, if I had to, that, you know, support for support for aid to Pakistan and support for Pakistan really has been bipartisan over the years. I mean, the Kerry-Lugar bill, which is the last giant aid package to Pakistan, was very strongly supported on both sides of the aisle. So I don't know any particular reason why they would be wanting to woo the Republicans.
Pakistan was founded as an experiment in Muslim democracy in 1948. India was, of course, also a democracy, often called the world's largest democracy. Have their democracies been at all similar? They share a lot of culture, don't they, despite the differences in religion?
Yes, certainly they do. In fact, it's a little-known fact that there are probably more Muslims still today in India than in most countries in the world, with, I think, the exception of maybe Malaysia and Indonesia.
And Pakistan now.
And Pakistan,
so it's third or fourth in the world.
Yeah, it's very high. So in other words, that culture is still very much alive there. But to answer your question, I mean, the diversion of their democratic paths, I would like to stress, I don't think has much to do with religion at all. I think it has much more to do with leadership. I think India has been blessed with a democratic system that has become more mature and robust as time has gone on. It's been blessed with a succession of leaders. Obviously, they had different points of view, but who've all been, you know, highly competent and committed to democracy. Whereas in Pakistan, you've had, you know, on paper a similar kind of government, but whose inspirational founder died very soon after the founding of Pakistan. And since then, the country really has been cursed with a succession of leaders who were either, you know, not good, who died prematurely, or who were intervened upon by the army.
Well, India has had its leanings toward authoritarianism over the years. Indira Gandhi wasn't exactly the most democratic leader, but it's always righted itself. And it seems that Pakistan has been unable to right itself. And you're saying that's largely because of the power of the military?
That's a huge factor. In fact, the entire sort of obsession with India as the great enemy has really skewed and I think perverted what could have been a much more balanced civilian-oriented government.
Well, India, of course, sees Pakistan as the great enemy.
Right, but not as much of a threat by any means. I mean, obviously, they're both nuclear powers, but look at the size, look at the economy. India's economy is, you know, huge compared to Pakistan's.
Although, doesn't Pakistan have a valid complaint about the way India has handled Kashmir?
Yes. I mean, it's an old dispute, and there are, you know, many sides to it, many arguments to be made. You know, obviously the Pakistanis feel that, you know, it's been riding roughshod. India has been sort of riding roughshod over the rights of Kashmiris, that they've never settled it. They've gone back on the promises made to the UN, et cetera, et cetera. As I say, it's not a new struggle. But if you look at sort of the recent history, you have, you know, guerrillas going in and, you know, doing deadly ambushes, suicide bombings.
Shooting up Mumbai.
Well, yeah, but I just meant particularly on Kashmir. You know, the struggle has very much been two-sided. And yes, now, of course, the expansion into other parts of India.
Pakistan continues to ask that Kashmiris be allowed to vote and then allow the results to stand. And it's quite clear that if there were a plebiscite, that Kashmir would either become independent or move over to Pakistan, wouldn't it?
I think it's become fairly clear in recent years that they would not vote to become part of Pakistan. It seems that the great majority of Kashmiris would either want to become independent or part of India, but with a much more autonomous kind of self-governance or semi-self-governance.
I've wondered what the fact that India and Pakistan both have nuclear weapons actually means in the end. They're not going to drop bombs on each other.
Their governments certainly are not, but the fear has always been, certainly in the West, that somebody else would get control of Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. The governments, even the bad ones, have always asserted strongly that this could never happen, would never happen, that the command and control system. But nowadays, you know, you have a number of other actors in Pakistan who have, you know, nefarious motives and may well not be under the control of the security state.
You've been reporting from Pakistan since 1998. Do most Pakistanis believe that they can use the democratic system in their country to affect change?
I would say not. I would say that there's an enormous amount of disillusionment with the democratic system. Again, going back to failures of leadership over the years, one of the points I try to make in my book is that, you know, we've got 180 million people in this country, the majority of whom feel powerless, even though they are in, allegedly, you know, a constitutional democracy. They don't see it working in their lives. They don't see it representing them.
And it's my sense from, for example, I've seen a couple of documentaries on the Bhutto family, that they promised so much and then delivered so little that that would be another reason for disillusionment.
Although mentioning the Bhuttos, they probably delivered or certainly tried to deliver much more than a number of other leaders. And, of course, both the father and the daughter were assassinated.
And Zia-ul-Haq being the bad guy in most of the scenarios.
Right. And you know, it's not only that, but the fact that he used the religion of Islam for political purposes and really, again, the my title, Playing with Fire, you know, he really tried to use Islam in a way that heavily politicized it and took it very far from its traditional role in that society.
He imposed Sharia law. Is that still in place? Are those laws still the laws of Pakistan?
Well, it's still a constitutional democracy. It's not a Sharia state the way Iran and Saudi Arabia are. It's still a constitutional democracy, but it's a democracy within the rubric of Islam or within the parameters of Islam.
What has the impact of the floods of July through August 2010 had on the country as a whole?
It's really been a telling and a very revealing episode. You know, obviously, it's done devastating damage to the land, long-term damage, because it wasn't just that the waters came in, is that they swept away a lot of the nutrients. I mean, the soil in many, many parts of this agricultural economy has been destroyed. And, of course, many, many people, you know, millions of people lost their homes. So economically and socially, it's had, you know, a huge impact.
But, are farmers even going back to their land?
Yes, a lot of them have. A lot of them didn't have any choice. And they're struggling to rebuild. And there has been, you know, a significant amount of aid that's come in. But one of the things that it's also done politically, it really shook things up. I mean, there's been a lot of sort of, you know, sort of moving around in the political heartlands and a lot of a lot more grassroots activism has sprung from this.
Well, the estimates of the damage exceed $10 billion. That's an awful lot of money. How much of it has come in from the outside? Because I can't imagine much of it is coming from Pakistan itself.
In terms of aid?
Yeah.
Obviously, there was aid from all over the world. There was aid from UN agencies, aid from the West, quite a bit from the United States, although most Pakistanis never got that message that there was a lot of help coming from the West. But to be honest, there was also a lot of skepticism and concern. The international aid organizations, as well as the Western democracies, were extremely worried about corruption and about the money going to the wrong places. So the sympathy factor was not as strong as it might have been once.
The World Bank says that the floods have hindered real GDP growth, which was projected at 4.5% this year, is now expected to slow down to somewhere between around 2.5%.
Which the country cannot afford. It's already importing things like sugar and wheat that it ought to be exporting. It's already very needy.
My guest is Pamela Constable. Her book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. It is published by Random House, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Pamela Constable, who is a foreign correspondent, former deputy foreign editor at The Washington Post, who has been covering Pakistan extensively since 1998, also Afghanistan, India, and Iraq. She your earlier books have been on other things. Like you were co-author of A Nation of Enemies, Chile, under Pinochet.
Yes, I spent a lot of time there.
Now, Chile is a country that has been able to right itself, but it had a rough time. Do you see the possibility for Pakistan, or is Pakistan just have too many problems?
It's a very interesting comparison. I mean, I think Chile had more going for it in terms of a stronger tradition of public leadership and democratic institutions. But Pakistan has plenty of potential to be a successful, prosperous, modern country. It just needs to change some of its priorities.
It has potential because of the it's mostly agricultural. Doesn't that automatically keep a country down?
Not necessarily. It depends on, you know, what happens to the land. Of course, Pakistan also has a large industrial infrastructure. It's a major exporter of textiles and other products, surgical instruments, for example. But in terms of agriculture, the real problem is not the fact that it's a rural economy, but the fact that it's never really had serious land reform of any kind. There's still very much a feudal mentality in much of the land ownership in terms of attitude towards the population. You know, many, many people live in essentially bonded servitude on the land. They don't get educated. Their kids don't get educated, and they're stuck at the bottom.
So there's little social mobility?
Yes. In rural areas, that's very often the case, and it's been very difficult to change that.
And what about child labor?
Child labor is a major part of the economy there, both rural and urban. You see, you know, small children working in brick-making yards. You see them working in fields. And in the cities, many, many small children work as domestic servants.
Now, one thing that we assume about Pakistan is that it's a Muslim country, but aren't there many different kinds of Muslim groups there, and hasn't there been a lot of tension?
Indeed. It is very, very largely a Muslim society. There's a fairly large Christian community, which I believe about 20 million. But the real dichotomy is really between not so much only because they're between Sunni and Shia. The great majority are Sunni Muslims. So within Sunni Islam, there are major cleavages within the society. I mean, to put it sort of simplistically, between the sort of more radical and the more moderate strains.
And we see bombings sometimes, which is Muslim upon Muslim killing. Why? Are there some people so ideologically pure that they can't stand anyone else being around?
I think it's...
I'm not talking about the Taliban. No, I'm talking about within the big cities.
Well, you know, a lot of the attacks, you know, we have to sort of think about defining the Taliban. There's a Taliban up in the northwest. These are the ethnic Pashtuns. They're from the Afghan border regions. But there's also this Punjabi Taliban, these other militant groups that are really in the heartland of the country in places where you've seen these bombings, like, for example, bombings at the major Sufi shrine in Lahore, which was clearly done by militants. But these were not people who came from hundreds of miles away up near Afghanistan.
And what's their beef against the Sufi, who are a peaceful people?
Well, it's part of their broader attack on what you might call the more moderate, I don't want to use the word, but anyway, the more secular, the more sort of open-minded, a more tolerant vision for the society itself.
You write that the low wages, lack of social mobility, and corruption in government have led many Pakistanis to turn to radical Islam. How are radical clerics recruiting members?
I would say that there's several key issues for people. One of them is the lack of justice. I mean, the court system is woefully inadequate. People do not feel that they can get justice. What these radical groups offer is a form of justice. It's their kind of justice. It's Sharia law. It's more effective, more efficient, more brutal, but it gets things done. And of course, it fits in with people's notions of this is, you know, their religion, so they don't feel as afraid of it as we might. But the other issue in terms of the appeal of religion is just that people feel increasingly they're being told that, you know, their religion is under siege from the West, especially since 9/11, that they need to defend their religion, whatever that means. And so there's a much more emotional embrace of Islam now in Pakistan, which doesn't necessarily mean that people support radical violence. It means that they feel very strongly about their religion, and that's making them more sort of muscular in defending it.
But I remember how surprised I was when the majority of lawyers came out in defense of A.Q. Khan, the father of Pakistan's nuclear program, who was found to be selling it off to North Korea and Libya and all sorts of other places. I would have thought the lawyers would have believed in the rule of law.
It's such an interesting – this is a country so full of contradictions. I mean, here you had the lawyers who led the movement to restore the independent judiciary, the restoration of democracy, the overthrow of General Musharraf. And yet some of these same lawyers, when it comes to issues of religion, people are different. I mean, in the case of the assassination of the provincial cabinet, provincial governor in January, who had been accused of essentially blasphemy against Islam because he was defending someone who'd been accused of blasphemy. When his assassin was brought to court, there were lawyers who congratulated him, along with throngs of thousands of ordinary believers who congratulated him.
So this is just comes down to religious belief? I mean, how does a government deal with that? Even if the Pakistani government was everything the United States fantasized it could be, how could it deal with that?
Well, so far it's just been backing off, and it's been ceding more and more political space to religious groups in general and most worrisomely to some of the more radical ones. It doesn't. The civilian government doesn't have that much power, and that's part of the problem.
Well, the civilian government went after the Red Mosque.
Actually, that was a military government. That was in – Musharraf was in power at that time, and it was his decision, but he made it very, very reluctantly. That was in June of 2007, and that was a mosque, of course, a radical mosque that had bunkered – you know, they'd bunkered themselves with weapons right in the middle of the capital.
They were stockpiling weapons there?
They were stockpiling
with
weapons.
With what end in mind?
They saw it as a sort of a bastion, a redoubt, a sort of, you know, I don't know what, a citadel somehow of their vision of Islam. And it was full of seminary students, including girls, who were sending out these vigilante squads to harass people they thought were sort of not following the Islamic way of life. So it really was a threat to the order.
Was it seen as a kind of a Waco incident in Pakistan?
I guess you could put it that way. It was highly controversial. I mean, even the reverberations, you know, have still gone on. It ended up uniting many of these militant groups, Islamic militant groups, some of whom were against the government, many of whom were supported by or supporting the government, and that changed completely. Then they all sort of united against the government as a result.
Well, there were an awful lot of young recruits, you say, at the mosque. Where were they getting their weapons from?
I don't know, but there's certainly, you know, Pakistan is awash with weapons. It always has been ever since the Afghan wars, many of which, you know, came from us. You know, Pakistan was the major conduit for fighting the Soviet Union at one point. So it's a country full of weapons with one of the largest military establishments in the world.
My guest is Pamela Constable. Her book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself, published by Random House. It's a Random House? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is WNY. Sometimes I even doubt myself. I'm at war with myself. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Can you explain the title?
Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. It's a country whose leaders have always thought that they could manage things, contain things, keep under control some of the demons that they were unleashing against India and elsewhere. And now it looks as if they've lost control.
Well, they have to deal with radical Islamic groups that are openly hostile to their policies. But then we hear about certain parts of the government, especially in the ISI, that are supporting those radical groups. So is that part of the way it's at war with itself?
Exactly. It's not a simple picture, and the institutional part of it is not is only part of the story. There are many different actors in Pakistan, many different sources of power, many covert, many semi-acknowledged and unacknowledged groups and individuals who are out there dealing with the bad guys, maintaining relations with them, and in some cases actively supporting them.
And supporting some pretty wild militant groups, again, because of Kashmir? Is that the source of so many of these problems?
I mean, Kashmir is just a flashpoint. Really.
But those groups often were founded as to fight against the Indian the Indians in Kashmir.
That's right. But it's really if the bigger picture is that Pakistan really does see India as the enemy. So you have to sort of filter all their foreign policy actions through that notion. And everything they're doing in Afghanistan, again, they see Afghanistan as a sort of strategic buffer in their backyard that they can use against India.
The United States has sent billions of dollars in aid, but many of the clerics regularly preach against the United States.
Indeed.
What are they saying?
Yeah, there's an incredible sort of love-hate relationship at this point. You know, I've listened to a lot of the sermons. I always go with translators and have them translate, you know, what the preachers are saying. And they just rant and rave, and they connect all these dots, you know, Palestine, Chechnya, Bosnia, 9/11, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan. They describe it very emotionally as being all part of a giant plot against.
And the United States is behind the plot,
along with its friends India and Israel. They always mention all three together.
India was not particularly friendly to Israel for most of its history.
That is a scholarly fact that probably most people in Pakistan would not know about.
How is Pakistan regarded by its neighbors in the region? I know we've spoken to people from Afghanistan who see Pakistan as the major source of their problems. India, of course, sees it as its prime enemy. What about some of the other countries in the area?
Well, just to go back to Afghanistan for a minute, because that's very interesting. I mean, both countries basically hate each other. I mean, they were always talking about brotherly love and sharing a long border. But, you know, most—
And sharing people, too, because the Pashtun live in both countries.
And sharing tribes, absolutely. But most Afghans see Pakistan as the source of, you know, all its problems, whereas most Pakistanis see Afghanistan as a source of, you know, millions of refugees, guns, drugs, problems. So there's this mutual real resentment between the two. Now, the most interesting relationship right now is with China. Pakistan has become closer and closer to China in recent years, particularly as its relationship with the West has become rockier and full of mutual mistrust. Now,
but that's also because China has had a lot of tension with India.
That's right. So, you know, China's motives are complicated and not necessarily a pro-Pakistan because they love Pakistan. But Pakistan, of course, would like to take advantage of that. And it's been reaching out very aggressively to China in the past several years.
And how does China reconcile the fact that they are so harsh on the Uyghur minority, their Islamic group, that in many ways shares all sorts of beliefs with what the people in Pakistan?
Well, again, you know, foreign policy and domestic policy don't necessarily go together in some of these situations.
We recently spoke to Peter Thompson, who was the special envoy to Afghanistan from 1989 to 1992, and he's visited the country many times since. And he sees the ISI as Afghanistan's major problem.
Well, many Afghans feel the same way. Of course, Pakistan denies this robustly, but there's no denying that its intelligence services have played an important role in originally training, originally training the Afghan militia groups that fought the Soviet Union. Then that sort of deviated and detoured into something else.
And then the Taliban all were formed in Pakistan and then invaded from Pakistan, even if they were Afghan.
Yeah, and again, we're not talking about Afghanistan today, but what's particularly important to remember is that for Afghans, the Taliban are not men from Mars. I mean, these are their fellow tribesmen, their co-religionists. They're part of the landscape.
What possibilities are there that the grassroots organizations that have formed in the wake of the recent floods might begin a democratic awakening in the country?
It's begun to happen in certain places, particularly in southern Punjab, where you have some very active grassroots politicians that are coming out of all this. Less so in Sindh, which is poorer and has less local representation and has long been dominated by the People's Party, which is now in power. So there's been less sort of upward mobility in rural Sindh. I think this is really going to be a question of a generation, though, because even still, the political elite, members of parliament, it's still very, very feudal-minded and still very elitist.
I always imagine these things, but wonder whether it would ever be possible. If someone would come to power who was really against corruption, would refuse to engage in nepotism, would that person succeed in Pakistan?
Well, they would certainly be beloved. They would certainly be beloved. I mean,
why is there so much corruption, no matter who's in power?
Well, you know, there's corruption everywhere. I mean, there's, you know, long
more
list
in some
of,
places than
more,
others.
More in some places. There's plenty of corruption in India, for example. I mean, you know, so it's not like a unique situation. You know, I there's several factors. One is because you've had so much strong military influence for a long time, the civilian institutions are weaker, and that includes, you know, the tax collectors and the organizations whose job it is to monitor and to watchdog. Civic society is very weak in Pakistan. So, you know, there are human rights groups, but they don't have that much influence. So there's not a lot of countervailing pressure against the military and against the bureaucracy and the corrupt system. So I would say there's not more of a corrupt proclivity, but there's less of a counterpoint.
Pamela Constable is a foreign correspondent, former deputy foreign editor for The Washington Post. Her latest book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself, it's published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very, very welcome.